Well, hello everyone. We're trying to mess around a little bit with our Zoom view in the Zendo so that we can see when one of you speaks, we can see you a little enlarged, but we don't miss everybody else. You can probably leave it like that for now because everybody's back. All right, so I will go around and greet people on Zoom, and then those in the Zendo can introduce themselves. So start with Bob, Andy, Amelia, Joseph, Dennis, Pat, Paulette, Christina, Mary, Chris, Ellen, John, Brian, Melissa, Phil, Etzido, Jeannie, Henry, Mark, Lori, Coral and Carson, apparently they were in the Zendo and now they went home. Hello. Travis and Ruth Ann. And in the Zendo? Kazu. Alice. Jim. Linda. And Domio. All right. Let's see, in terms of announcements, I guess the one announcement is just about term student. The opening retreat for that is on Saturday, February 26th, and there's information about it that'll come out in the newsletter and is online. So consider signing up for that, opening and closing retreats, and tying together the term with some term vows and getting to know the other people who are in the program. Any questions about upcoming stuff or anything else I should announce? All right, I'll just get started then. In a way, this is a continuation of my challenges in Zazen series, but it's big enough to be a thing unto itself. So I do have more things to cover in the challenges in Zazen later. Makyo, what I call the blender effect, where thoughts just go through your head so fast and randomly, it's really annoying. boredom and frustration. So we'll get to those. But today, I wanted to talk about something called depersonalization, which I will define, and its relationship to the emptiness of self. But I'll preface this in the same way that I have these other discussions of experiences and challenges in Zazen and encourage you to just do your own practice and not compare yourselves to ideals or to others. There are some things that I might be describing in this series of talks which sound like things you want to have happen or you don't want to have happen, or they happen more for you than somebody else or something. And, you know, we can get kind of tied up in terms of how does your Zazen, how does your practice compare to that of others, or how should it be? And it's so varied and beyond definition that that's not a useful train to go down. So the experience of depersonalization, which I was not familiar with this term until a couple weeks ago. And I find it, but I'm familiar with the what it means. I'm familiar with the experience. I just didn't know there was a word for it. So as it's defined, it's depersonalization is a type of dissociation in which you have a sense of detachment from your identity, your thoughts, feelings, consciousness, memories, etc. And it's an unusual sense, right? It's not, the experience of depersonalization is you're feeling these kinds of things more strongly than you ordinarily do. And generally speaking, you know it's just a feeling. It's just an experience. You're not, you're like, huh, that's weird. That's a weird experience. You're still grounded in reality, but it can feel unnerving. It might feel like you're watching your life as if it's a movie, or there might be kind of an out-of-body experience. It may include things, according to what I researched anyway, include things like feeling physically numb, unable to control your speech or movement, difficulty relating to or identifying with feelings or memories or something that has happened to you. Unusual difficulty recognizing or describing your emotions. You might have issues with that generally, but this is, an unusual degree of that. Feeling like your head is wrapped in cotton, or like your body or limbs are distorted, like enlarged or smaller than they actually are. It's a very interesting constellation of symptoms here. So in this talk, I'm going to start off defining and describing this phenomenon and talk briefly about how to deal with it in terms of practice, and then explore more about how does this relate to the teachings of no self. So this particular site that I found helpful in describing this experience, interestingly says that it's fairly common for people to have this experience sometime over the course of their life. Something between like a quarter and three quarters of people report at some point in their life having some kind of experience like this. And it may be just a few seconds long, usually just a passing thing, but it can be a little scary or disorienting or unpleasant or distracting. It is more likely if you have past trauma, if you've experienced assault or abuse, or have a source of severe stress in your life. This is an experience that's commonly associated with PTSD and often occurs along with other things like depression and anxiety. But it's a spectrum all the way from just a few moments you might experience that are a little unusual all the way to a disorder, which is when these experiences become repeated and prolonged and disturbing enough that they interfere with your daily life. And I'll just say, if that is happening, definitely seek professional help. So I'm making an important disclaimer here that I am not a mental health professional. So I don't necessarily understand this phenomenon as defined in modern psychology, and I don't know how to diagnose it or treat it or anything like that. So I'm just kind of using this term, perhaps hopefully not in too inappropriate a way. So when I was recently introduced to this term, I had one of those experiences where you encounter a term or a definition for something that you have experienced or observed, but you didn't think there was a word for it. You didn't think there was a definition. You didn't think it was a thing, or that perhaps you you had experienced it, and it was kind of weird, and other people hadn't experienced it. And in particular, in reading those list of symptoms, and those that the weird ones about feeling like you're unable to control your speech or movement, feeling like your body or limbs are distorted. And I was like, huh, like I had that experience when I was a child, sometimes falling asleep, and I just had this oppressive sense of like I couldn't move, and the kind of the ceiling was pressing down on me, and my limbs were. And I knew this wasn't true. It would have been terrifying if I thought it was true, right? But I had this sense that my limbs were like hugely swollen and heavy, and I couldn't move them. And I don't remember ever, I don't remember how long it would last or how it would end. I'm guessing I probably just fell asleep or something. And I don't remember ever telling anybody about it because it was, how do you describe that? Like, oh, sometimes I have this feeling and I know it's not true. I don't know. But then here it was in this list of symptoms. Like, isn't that interesting? And then as, you know, I've shared in my story before, I mean, not to, you know, it's not that important to know why I had that experience, but this, the experience of depersonalization is associated with a little bit of a breakdown of fragility. I don't know how else to describe it, in your sense of self. And like I was saying earlier, this can be associated with trauma or abuse or other kinds of mental illness or something. So there are certain things that happen to us sometimes that tend to threaten that, you know, conventional sense of self we have. And again, I don't know, but it makes sense to me that I might have had this experience as a child, in part because I almost lost my mother when I was 3 and a half. She had viral pneumonia and she was pregnant with my sister and she disappeared for a couple weeks and she was really at death's door. And at the time, you know, when early in my life, I didn't think that had much of an impact on me. But then when my niece was 3 and a half, I realized she would pick up a lot of what was going on. So I think I always had a sense of, you know, this sense of self that I had that was dependent on my family life and my love and my parents, and all of this could just disappear very easily. So I think it gave me that kind of sense of that self was very fragile. Who knows? But it was fascinating to learn at age 50 that this is a thing other people have experienced, and that there is often a reason why. As far as I can tell, experiences of depersonalization are not necessarily negative or traumatic. It can be mild, subtle, brief, intriguing, unnerving. It's really only when it becomes prolonged or repeated, disturbing, that it becomes a problem. And ideally, so I do think meditation and Buddhist practice can make this more likely to happen. But I don't want to scare you off from meditation thinking, oh my God, you know, I'm going to start fracturing my sense of self and have these weird out-of-body experiences or something like that. I don't think it's common. I usually think it's pretty brief. From the point of view of practice, this is not unexpected. Through our zazen, through our Dharma study, in our practice, we are challenging our sense of self. We are inviting ourselves to consider that maybe this person, this narrative we've created about ourselves, is not as real as we thought. Meditation itself changes us. So I think it's, you know, it invites some of these unusual shifts in our perception of ourselves and our relationship to reality. We're opening up to new things. We're trying to see, right? All that list, our identity, our thoughts, our memories, our consciousness, we're trying to see them as empty, right? Not real in the way we think. And so it seems like, you know, that sense of kind of detachment from them or disconnection from them might be where we're trying to go. And I'm going to explain that it's really not, but it's kind of subtle. So, but I'll explain that in a bit. So what's important to understand very briefly, just in terms of how to practice with this, if you've had these kinds of experiences or if you have them in the future, we are not trying to dismantle our sense of self. We need our sense of self to function in order to function. We're trying to transcend our sense of self, to see the world as not just limited to our small sense of self and our narrative about it. So more on that in a bit. We actually need a strong sense of self to do this practice. So if you experience any kind of depersonalization, and this really goes for any of the challenges in Zazen, I'd say don't get too worried or excited about it. Talk to someone, me, another Zen teacher, a mental health professional, whatever. If it happens, you know, if it disturbs you at all or happens repeatedly. And if that's not the case, just take it as a sign that you are exploring new spiritual territory, which is a good thing. But be aware we're not looking to intensify or repeat that into the depersonalization. That's not the direction we want to go, which I'll explain in a moment. So one thing that's good is to maybe meditate a little less. I've heard of these kinds of things being more likely to happen. It's often someone who just, they're really excited about practice. And so they're like, all right, let's do this meditation thing. And then they meditate for 3 hours a day by themselves. And there's some of us who are like, wow, I can't imagine ever doing that. But there are people out there who do that. And that's very intensive meditation to be doing all by yourself without context, without support. So that kind of thing can bring this up sometimes. And then also, it doesn't necessarily have to be that much Zazen if you have past trauma, if you have issues and stuff, and you may not be aware of them. So if this stuff starts to come up, it's good to pay attention to it, but also recognize that one of the traps, I guess, is a certain kind of fascination with this kind of experience. It sounds kind of unpleasant, and sometimes frequently it is, but it also can just be kind of weird or wacky or far out. So, you know, oh, I just had a sense that like I dissolved and I was floating out in space and whatever. And there can be sometimes a tendency to think like that's what we're going for. And if you meditate some more, you're going to intensify that experience somehow and achieve what we're looking for. So I'm just saying, you know, back off from the kind of meditation that you're doing and emphasize perhaps other aspects of practice like precepts, opening the heart, spending time with Sangha, that kind of thing. But at the same time, it's not good to get fearful about having these kinds of experiences. So just keep in mind they're normal and they're just experiences. And chances are they're going to decrease and pass and not happen again unless you're trying to make them happen. So all of that said, what is the relationship between this depersonalization and the emptiness of self? Are we on to something when we have that experience? Isn't detaching from your emotions, memories, body, feelings, etc. a good thing? One online description I read said depersonalization often occurs, I don't really know the difference here, but they called it derealization, where you feel separate from the world around you and or see it as kind of unreal. And in the, when I read that description, it's kind of like, well, you might think that that was like maybe what we're looking to do as Buddhists, right? To kind of just like, you know, not feel overly involved and see everything as vaguely unreal. But that's not what we're trying to do, and I'll explain. So depersonalization, and I'm speaking here as a spiritual teacher, not as a mental health professional. But it seems like a dissolution or breakdown in your sense of self. Maybe little, very, very minor, maybe major. Instead of transcendence of self. So let's briefly review the Buddhist view of self. So we have a conventional designation of self. That's very, this in some senses, this is not even what we get upset about. It's the collection of all the stuff that we are and we have and we relate to. And an analogy that's in one of the traditional Buddhist scriptures is somebody asks this teacher, Nagasena, to explain the emptiness of self. Like, I'm here? What do you mean I don't exist? And so Nagasena says, well, you know, you came here in this chariot over here, right? So what is the chariot? If I just took the wheels, is that the chariot? No. If I just took the you know, carriage part, if I just took the, you know, lead to the horse, is that? No. Like, it all, but, you know, so where is the chariot? You can't find the chariotness in there, and yet all of it together functions as a chariot. So you say, I came in a chariot. It's no problem. So in a way, that's like this view of, I have a body, I have a personality, I have memories, I have conditioning, I have a house, and I have a dog, and I have a, you know, what? And so that's domio. You know, like there's the heap of stuff without even trying to find some kind of essence in it or whatever. So obviously that's a very useful definition of self. It's good to know what's mine, what's yours, and all that. But that's not really where we end up having a problem, right? So the other aspect of self is our sense of self-preservation, which we evolved and is adaptive. So as we navigate our lives, there's attraction and repulsion and indifference based on, does this seem threatening? Does this seem advantageous? Does this seem irrelevant? So we're negotiating as a living being. We're negotiating our environment. And somehow we've evolved this sense of ourselves and looking out for ourselves. And we even have this ability, which, you know, maybe other animals share it, but certainly humans have it to quite a degree, where we can conceive of ourselves through time as well, right? So it's not just looking out for my well-being this moment, but also charting out my well-being and safety and those of my family into the future. So this is where we presumably get our sense that we have an enduring, independent, inherent self-nature. There's someone in here. There's a homunculus in the machine, right? Who's running all of this and experiencing all of this. And obviously that sense of ourselves is very useful. We need it to survive. But it also causes, that is the source of so much of our grief. We're unable to see beyond the concerns and dictates and narratives of that small self. And therefore we're subject to dukkha, dissatisfaction. So in our practice, we're aiming to transcend that small sense of self, but in a way that includes it and does not create duality. So we're not going for a better sense of self and looking down on this lesser sense of self, and we're going to try to operate with this greater sense of self and reject the lesser self. We're aiming for a greater sense of self that isn't limited to this, as the Buddhists like to say, this skin bag, but it's also not the least bit troubled or defiled by this skin bag. It's bigger and includes. When we talk about the emptiness of self, it can sound negative, but it's not meant to be. Emptiness requires something to be empty of something that you expect to be there. So a glass is empty of water, a house is empty of people. The emptiness implies like you expected something to be in there. So in a way, emptiness is a beautiful term for describing our relationship to this, you know, small sense of self. We think there really is a real enduring self in there. And then if we look closely, we realize actually our being is empty of such a thing. We thought there was something real in there, and it's not there. So it's a kind of negative definition, but it is pointing to an absence of something we expected. And we want to have a direct experience of this emptiness, if you will. And it can be disorienting in a way that is somewhat similar to depersonalization, but only because it's similarly rewriting our sense of self, but in a different way, in a constructive way, not in a destructive way. But it can be, and I think that's sometimes where the confusion arises, where we think, you know, of experience of depersonalization is on track, when it's like, you know, where the, because these awakening to the emptiness of self can be pretty disorienting too. But it's different. I'll talk about that. Because we don't, in our practice, we don't stop at emptiness. So that's kind of a gateway in a way. We're like, all right, we assumed there was this sense, this real self in there. And somehow through meditation and study, I don't know, at some moment we realize, huh, this is not as real as I thought. It's ephemeral, it comes and goes. And so we begin to appreciate our being as empty of this thing that we assumed was there. But we don't stop there. Then we say, Well, then what am I? What is my nature? I assumed it was dependent on this thing inside me, this homunculus in the machine. If there's no homunculus in the machine, how do I even know how to operate? Like, what is the nature of this being? So in Genjo Koan, which we study a lot, Dogen explains famously, to study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be verified by all things. To be verified by all things is to let the body and mind of the self and the body and mind of others drop off. There is a trace of realization that cannot be grasped. We endlessly express this ungraspable trace of realization. So I'm only going to talk about the first few sentences of that, but I wanted to share the whole thing. So we study the self. We look closely at our sense of inherent self. So I heard this explained in a helpful way, I think, that we're not looking for true self. We're looking for our delusion about self. That's what we can find. Our true nature is not something that we can like grasp and say, ah, there it is, I figured it out on Thursday. right? It's experiential. It won't be like that. But we can seek out our assumptions and delusions about self. So we study the self. And at some point, some moment, we forget the self. And it might be through a kind of an insight, like, oh, the self is empty. Or it might be more like just for a moment we're able to operate without that filter, without that self-centered filter that we usually, we're perceiving everything through, we're interpreting everything through, we're relating to everything through, and just, you know, that lifts, and because of practice, we notice that, and we, huh, isn't that interesting? What's that about? So we forget the self. And, as Dogen says, when we forget the self, we are verified by all things. Or, I also like the term actualized by all things, and prefer that. So what's that about? So Kaz Ta-Nehisi is a translator of Buddhist stuff, and he likes to translate the ancient Buddhist term shunyata, which is typically translated as emptiness or void. He likes to translate it as boundless. And as I said, empty has its place. If we just talked about boundless, I don't know, it could be a little airy-fairy and, you know, skip the part where we need to study the self and forget the self. But boundless, I think, is a better word for the truth of our being. It's not just negative. It's not just, well, there is an inherent self in there. What is it? Actually, it is boundless. We are dependently co-arisen with everything else in the universe, literally and metaphysically. And I don't know, just for fun, just to explore this, literally, you are composed of atoms that have been many other things. You are the result of actions and decisions and the bodies of countless direct ancestors, most of whom you will never even know. We are the products of evolution, culture, and education. Your body is made up of food and water that countless other beings have provided for you. Your existence is dependent this moment on gravity and air and the warmth of the sun and the Earth's atmosphere. And then metaphysically, moment by moment, our consciousness is shaped by everything within and around us. We don't exist independently of all of this. Where is the separation between you and the bird singing outside the window? The bird sings, and he only sings because sound can be perceived. The vibrations in the air reach your ears and cause changes in your brain chemistry that allows you to become conscious of the sound and even make associations with it. Can even visualize what the bird might look like, even though you're just hearing a sound. And you may identify with your experience of hearing, your ability to ID the bird, or your conclusion, what a pretty sound, right? I'm sitting here, I think, oh, I'm sitting here meditating, and I hear a bird, and I think this about the bird. But what makes a sound pleasant? Who taught you the name of a bird? What is a name? Why do we even get satisfaction from knowing anything? Experientially, forgetting the self and being actualized by all things is an expansive sense of non-separation. So rather than the self being minimized and or shown to be a nihilistic void, it's a sweet recognition that we are much, much bigger and more connected than we thought. we recognize we're part of everything, that belonging is not in any way, not for a moment, compromised by the fact that we live out our lives inside a skin bag, walking around most of the time completely self-absorbed. It doesn't matter. I mean, it does matter in the sense that we would like to learn to be more mindful and live in a way that generates less suffering, right? So it matters to us. But this belonging to this greater whatever, this greater life, this greater reality, is not compromised in any way by our limitations. And perhaps we start to protest that we can't truly belong because of this or that human limitation or shortcoming. And I like to just picture the Buddhas being those who have realized, awakened to reality before us. I just picture the Buddhas laughing, you know, and saying, but I'm like this, I make these mistakes and I'm never mindful and whatever. And be like Buddhas, be like, so what? So what? So again, we are aiming to transcend our small sense of self, not destroy it. We need it, and frankly, we're never going to get rid of it. We're aiming for a bigger perspective, which puts the small self in context and frees us at least a little bit from being completely controlled and distressed by its dictates. So the process of awakening to our true nature, to our boundless nature, to what's sometimes said, our true self is no self. It can sound a little negative again, but if you think about self as being by definition separate, then like essentially you're saying our true self is, there's no separate self. So awakening to this ourselves can be challenging. Along the way, partial glimpses of this can be unnerving. They might even, you know, bring a little sense of depersonalization or a fear, perhaps, of nihilism. I know that even though this seems very irrational when I say it out loud, I was concerned early on in sitting that if I kind of let go too completely, that I would just disintegrate or lose it or go crazy or something. Like I had a sense that I needed to hold on to what was, you know, familiar, what was keeping me, you know, keeping myself together, or who knows what would happen, right? So I think of this sometimes in terms of like, we're learning to swim, you know, in the ocean of reality, and at first we're really nervous and somebody says, just relax, you can float. And we're like, I don't know. So we have to work toward it. And another analogy or metaphor I like is you're dipping your toe into the ocean. You know, you're scared to go in, it's really cold. You dip your toe in, you back up. Whew, that's enough for today, you know, and you're maybe like, get your foot in. And so if we can't really make ourselves, most of us, and it's a good thing, we can't just make ourselves just go jump right in. It takes some integration and some getting used to. So a huge part of our path is getting to know ourselves and then accepting ourselves, accepting our karma, which is the result of past causes and conditions, many of which were not our doing, some of which were, I mean, biological, chemical, cultural, whatever. Somehow we ended up in this body and this mind and this life and this situation. We have our strengths and weaknesses. We have our quirks. weaknesses and neuroses. Maybe we end up with past trauma that has resulted in a fragile or reactive sense of self. Maybe we have such low self-esteem that we have problems setting boundaries and knowing our own needs and desires. Maybe we suffer from mental illness or addiction. But none of these prevent our awakening. None of them disqualify us from belonging, from boundlessness. What they do is mess with our sense of self. And before we can forget or transcend our small sense of self, that basic instinctual drive to self-preservation, we actually need to heal and strengthen it. And there's no shame in this. It's not lesser work than forgetting the self. Taking care of the self isn't just settling into complacent self-indulgence and laziness. That's actually not healing. Taking care of the self, however, might mean getting counseling or therapy. It might mean appropriate medication for physical or mental illnesses. Getting enough sleep, eating well, exercising. It might mean working on your human relationships. Learning to set boundaries, make requests, receive help, give more generously, open to intimacy. It might mean facing and working with your emotions or your memories or your narratives, learning to accept the past and present, exploring better ways to live. Zen is not a self-improvement project. We don't dwell on our conventional self or our small sense of self because it's the be-all and end-all of existence. Because no matter how healthy or robust our sense of self is, no matter how much healing and acceptance and improvement we do, it will ultimately fail to be a satisfying and permanent refuge. That's just the way of things. It's not a negative comment on the nature of small self. That's just the way things are. We seek that bigger perspective of boundlessness, of belonging, of being actualized by all things. But at the same time, we don't seek to disparage or dismantle the small self, let alone destroy it. A strong sense of self gives us the resilience we need to do this practice, which involves many challenges to our sense of ourselves. So you might have lots of self-exploration and healing to do right now. Or you might not have so much to do right now. But challenges in the future, illness, loss, old age, disease, death, mental illness, you know, you may have to take some time to take care of the self. And I think it's important that we see all of that as part of the path. All of it is part of what we do together as a Sangha, as opposed to seeing the studying the self as like lesser or preliminary or something like that. And then, you know, what we're really trying to do is just let go of, get rid of the self. So that is great. Now we have 15 minutes for comments and questions. Anyone who is online, feel free to hit the reactions button and choose raise hand, and then your hand will remain raised, or do it the old-fashioned way. And Alice in the Zendo here.
As listening to you, I felt a little bit of depersonalization. You know, being immersed and like really feeling what it's like to be.
You want to come move your chair?
Oh. Feeling what it's like to be empty and with everything. It invoked a lot of fear. Mm-hmm. like, I almost just wanted to, like, take off my mask and just run away. Because I, you know, I'm going to put this very bluntly, I don't want to lose my sanity, if that makes sense. You know, not that I identify with my role or my clothes or my home or my car. I don't really identify that with my sense of self, but there's this groundedness that you feel, okay, I'm Alice, but then who am I? And then if you go down that rabbit hole, I get really freaked out that maybe I don't exist, and then I'm gonna lose it. I'm gonna lose it, and I'm gonna go crazy, and I don't know what's gonna happen. So, just wanted to share that.
I think, again, experiences are really varied. So, I mean, I think it's pretty typical and pretty, like, totally makes sense that we experience some fear and trepidation as we do this, walk this path. But some people might not. I don't know. But I know that I did, and it's really, so there's all these different levels of studying the self, right? So you're kind of talking about how, all right, you got it. Like, your job and your clothes and whatever aren't you. And so we begin to, it's not an all or nothing thing, right? We begin to appreciate, all right, those things aren't me. But when you get down to, like, there's some really fundamental, really primal thing at the core of us that is like, I gotta watch out here. And I think that is good. It's like, it's like this will, it's this will to life, which we should be hardwired with. If we don't, it's actually a problem. That hardwired will to life, but it's like we have delusions about what that life depends on. And so we're never going to just be like, well, who cares about me? But we have delusions about what that is. I don't know. There's no way to describe exactly how to go down that path of like, okay, now we'll let go of that delusion. Maybe the thing that comes to my mind is a Pali Canon Sutta where the Buddha talks about all these different views of self. And he says, basically, any of these are an obstruction. Any of these are a delusion. And it's this exhaustive list of like, I exist. I will exist after I die. I won't exist after I die. I exist in my body. I don't exist in my body. I'm going to, you know, I don't exist at all. I exist only in my mind. I only think I exist. Like, all these, like, every permutation you can think of. And he says, like, those are all, as long as there is this sense of that separateness that could be under threat, that in a way that is the delusion of self, right? And we can't just excise it out. It feels like we have to just get very, very intimate with it and recognize it and question it. And then it's almost like we just stumble upon something different at some point because we are exploring and looking. Just, you know, one day we're just like, what if I just shifted my attitude just like this a little bit, and I let go of that, I, you know, swam out into the ocean, let go of the side of the pool, and just floated and saw what happened. And that is where that incredibly, it's just incredibly encouraging to us. I'm still alive! I'm still here! Yeah, like, you realize, like, it's not, it's that life is not dependent on maintaining our ideas. Brian.
So thank you. It's such a slippery concept that you kind of periodically kind of say, gosh, oh, I thought I had it, and now I don't. And but the thing that, you know, I read once that made a lot of sense to me was that it's not that you're empty of everything. It's not getting to a vacuum. It's that you're empty of the gunk, you know, the sense of, you know, the enduring self. I'm all these things. And so for me, the thing I found that sort of brought me to meditation and sort of, you know, kept me going was that I felt that I was shedding a lot of that, and that what was more active in me was that, you know, primary, you know, I don't know what it is, but the, you know, your Buddha nature, your something, the good, you know, the thing in you that wants to love, that wants to connect, that, you know, our Buckminster Fuller once said that he didn't know what he was, but he was certain he wasn't a noun. He thought he was a verb. And you only tell yourself that every now and again, maybe every, I don't know, 3 weeks or 4 weeks, you sort of lose your hold on it. It's so slippery. And then it's good to have you talk about it, because it kind of brings it back into, you know, you feel like you have more conceptual hold of it. So anyway, so thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I guess another way to describe it is like, when we're on the verge of letting go, and we kind of think, well, I need to let go of this. I need to let go of this sense of self. I need to let go of this. And it feels like we're letting go of something real and important. But afterwards, you realize the only thing that's different, the only thing that's missing, is your fear. That's the old, like, you think, oh my God, if I let go, it's all going to be, you know, like, it'll all fall apart. It'll be transcendently different or something. The only thing that's different is this concept that you are holding on to in your head. Everything actually operates perfectly fine without that. We get it back. That sense of ourselves coalesces again. It needs to. It's natural. But it doesn't matter, you know, once you even just for a moment just seen, I like to say it's not just self and no self, it's like there's less self, right? You can have this experience of less self, and that makes you start to go, how deep does this go? You know, if I assumed that was essential and that's not really essential, Ruthann, did you have something?
Oh, I see this talk timely, because this time of year, when already thinking about spring, and I took Jukai in June 2020, so I see this as a review for myself in terms of looking at the precepts with new eyes, or kind of coming around again, sort of. So this is very timely. Thanks for this. And I like the last comment from Buckminster Fuller, we are a verb, I think. Thanks.
Thank you. Mary.
There we go. I just wanted to say that It was a great talk, first of all, really broadened the scope of the whole situation for each of us, and it's unique in its own way. But in my experience, the times that I've had a few moments of being connected to something greater than myself, it has offered the broadening of human experience. And then you want to know more about the self. So it sort of works. It's sort of a cycle within, you know, itself. It works beautifully. So thank you. That was lovely.
Yeah, that's a very good point. You taste, that's it, right? You taste a little bit of it and you go, oh, ordinarily I'm so far from that. And why is that?
Yes.
Hey.
Yeah, it's very motivating.
Chris?
The very first part you were talking about, your experience of depersonalization, and that I connected that with experiences in my life and things that I've learned with my younger daughter, who had some challenges, particularly when she was very small. And there's a lot of science related to sensory integration disorder among children that speaks to exactly like why those sorts of physical experiences happen and how they're linked to, psychological and emotional experiences as well, and why they still come up as adults. So it's something that's really interesting and helped me as a parent. So that was one thought I had, for if anybody's interested in learning more about that, that's a way to explore it. And the second thing that struck me when you were talking about the idea of like having fear along the path, I had an experience when I was practicing as a young person when I was in my like late teens, early 20s. And I had somebody who was kind of a spiritual practitioner in a different, a very different background. And they said to me, oh, yeah, you can go seeking no self. Like, that's the thing you can do. But that's just spiritual suicide. And it brought, at that time in my life, it brought my practice to an immediate grinding halt. I was like, whoa, like, what if they're right? And I couldn't, like, it took me a long time, and it came back to finding a teacher who was able to help me through some of the things that you just said. So definitely identified with that sense of fear that can come up around those experiences or even just the concepts themselves.
Thank you. Yeah, it's, and I think that's probably the value of practicing within community, practicing with a teacher. Not that, you know, in my experience and my role as a teacher, I don't feel like I'm some kind of supernatural expert who knows exactly what's going on in your head and I can give you the exact solution to your problems. But someone, people around you who are witnessing can help. You can be like, does this sound crazy? You know, I had this experience. Does this sound okay? You know, so I found that very encouraging myself, was just going in to my teacher and just saying, I had this happen. You know, is that wrong? Is that right? Does this sound okay? And just, you know, like yeah, it sounds fine. Yeah. I mean, you think about some of the weird crap that I'm talking about in terms of challenges in Zazen, like next time we'll mention Makyo, which is like actually like mild hallucinations and things like that. And, you know, it'd be very encouraging to go and say, I had this experience. Somebody be like, yeah, we know it happens throughout time, tons of people, and this is how we deal with it. You know, it's very encouraging as you're messing with you're messing with yourself. You're messing with your body and mind, hopefully in a positive and constructive way. But there are going to be moments of shifts and concern and fear. So sometimes there is something, just, I know we're at 12:15, but there is something. So, you know, Kensho is the word for like a very dramatic experience of, you know, awakening to this no self, to this boundlessness of self. And, you know, for many of us, it's a gradual thing that happens over the course of many years. There's no one identifiable moment, but sometimes, and oftentimes it is associated with people who have trauma and issues, like, you know, it happens more. It's like almost like most of us, you know, we're able to just do the dip the toe into the ocean, but you know, some people just feel compelled to just jump right in. So you might have that experience, but there is something that I've heard of called a negative kensho, and I don't know that I even call it a kensho, but it is essentially, I think, where somebody has done this practice really intensely, but what they've actually evoked is a really intense experience of depersonalization, not what we're looking for. But it also can turn your life upside down. So I'll just mention that just in case, because if it happens to you, it really sucks. So if you ever hear of anybody it happening to, like, you know, spread the knowledge out there. All right, I will wrap it up then. Abiding in this ephemeral world like a lotus in muddy water. The mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming.
Thanks, everyone. Have a good week.